Yes, hello, is this Gary Brown?
This is he, who is this?
Yes, hi, how are you, sir? My name is Mike Penn.
How are you today, Mike?
I'm good. Well, so bear with me a second, I just have some standard permission stuff I need to run through. I'm tape recording this conversation for my own personal use as a journalist, so that I can ensure that the answers that you provide me are accurately represented. Today is August 2nd of 2002. Do I have your permission, sir, to record this conversation and to use its contents for publication?
Yes, go right ahead, Mike.
Very good. Thank you very much. I believe you got the list of questions that I have?
Yes, right here for Friday.
Very good. Would you like me to recant them for you? Or?
Yeah, you can phrase them the way you like. I appreciate you sending them along, but this is just so we can have some type of structure or discipline that considers, you know, time to the conversation. But go right ahead.
Okay, very good. My first question, and I did mention to Bryce, I had some other questions that were the product of an interview I did with Barbara Anderson, which you may want to address, but I'll leave that at your discretion. My first question was, why don't Jehovah's Witnesses adopt a call police first policy in all U.S. jurisdictions, not just those that mandate clerics as reporters of abuse?
Well, where we are now with this, and I think you're aware that we have over the years made adjustments in our policy, but now we are complying with whatever the state or country requires, and this we will do. If, for example, on the other hand, if there were some federal mandate that now every state was required that they make this a part of their law, then obviously we would comply. Will we make some adjustment prior to this? Well, I'm not part of the policy-making structure here, but I can see the question is one that is worthy of some consideration. So, in other words, you say, why don't we just adopt this policy? We continue to refine and make adjustments in our policy, and, of course, we do have in mind that the situation is one that deserves attention, and you can be assured we will give it appropriate attention.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me that would be a pretty simple step to take. I know that as an organization, you've always prided yourself on doing more than what is required, whether it's cleaning up a convention site or whatever, you know, to be exemplary. And it just seems that if you took that step, you could save yourself a lot of grief. You know, and you could leave the, for example, if it was murder, you know, of course I would think the elders would say, you know, this is a matter for the police. And some would argue that in some ways child sexual abuse is an even more grievous allegation. And if the elders could say to the publishers, you know, take this to the police and then we'll handle it internally, as we have the right to do as a religious order, you know, it would greatly simplify things, don't you think?
I'm familiar with the, you know, the example as, you know, you give it. Many have used a similar example, and of course the parallels run quite appropriate. But we have to have in mind this matter of child molestation has been sort of brought into the spotlight now. And so every organization is giving consideration to it, certainly religious, but then you have schools, you have other types of organizations. So I think it's a matter that needs to be reviewed in the light of the actual conditions that are there now. So while what you suggest is well taken, we can only respond as to where we are in the policy at this point in time. Are we adverse to following such a policy? Obviously not if we comply strictly with what the laws say on it and the states that require it, then that shows it's not something that we are adverse to in itself.
Yeah, I guess what I'm just struggling with, and not to belabor the point, is, you know, what the thinking is right now with your current policy that prevents you from doing that in states that don't mandate it.
It's not a matter of having a policy that prevents it. It's just, this is where we are now. If this continues to afford the protection to children that we feel is necessary, then there is no need to change. If following any policy puts seriously at risk the children in the organization, then I'm assured that it will be given proper attention by those who make the decisions as to what our policy is.
Okay, thank you. My second question is, and I'll try to explain myself clearly here. You know, my understanding is that if a family goes to the elders with an allegation of abuse, and there are no two witnesses who can serve as eyewitnesses of the offense, that the family is then admonished not to repeat the charge to someone else, for example, another sibling or relatives in the congregation, for fear of being disciplined by the congregation. Why is that, that the elders would threaten someone with congregation discipline for repeating an allegation in the hopes of protecting someone from what they view as a dangerous situation?
This is not our policy. Now, it may have been stated by some that they felt this principle applied. That is, you have scriptural principles that apply to slander or gossiping, and of course we make an effort to keep that out of the congregation. But when it comes to these serious matters of discipline, then we follow what is a standard procedure. You can report this to the elders. The elders will take a look into the matter. We're concerned about following the biblical principle of having two or three witnesses. It's clear over and over that this is a biblical standard. It's not one that is applied in society in general. It doesn't have to be.
Can I just ask a point of clarification on that? Isn't that an Old Testament requirement? And isn't the witness theology that, you know, the coming of Christ frees them from the Old Testament?
Not at all. It is mentioned first in the what you refer to the Old Testament, but it is restated a few times in what you would refer to as the New Testament.
Okay. Well, I don't want to distract from the actual question. So you're saying it's not policy for elders to admonish those who come forward with claims of abuse and not to repeat those claims to anyone else?
What do you mean by anyone? If they said to us,
Well, let me give you an example. I spoke with Barbara and Carl Pandello. I think you're familiar with their case. And I won't ask you to speak to their case specifically, but just as a for instance. They had allegations of abuse against Clement Pandello, and they were able to warn their worldly relatives that they suspected that he was abusing their child. They were not, according to them, able to warn their witness friends or relatives for fear of being disfellowshipped. Now, again, without addressing that particular case, would that accurately represent what has happened in a number of instances in different congregations?
Okay, not speaking specifically about that or any other case, and I think you understand why it would be appropriate to address that. But maybe just a little explanation, Mike, as to how this policy goes. And when you have any policy, it must be applied in a balanced way. I'm sure you can recognize you get valid allegations that are made, and while you may not be able to have the proof that's needed, they still seem to have the ring of truth. All right, this doesn't mean the matter is dismissed by the elders. The matter is taken under consideration, it's taken seriously, and if measures need to be taken to secure in some way the safety of other children in the congregation, the elders are more than willing to do it. Now, can the person go and make a report of this to authorities? Yes. Why? Because this is a crime, and we do not view reporting it to proper authorities as slander or gossip or spreading rumors. At the same time, you could take the scenario where here an allegation is made. Let's just for the sake of argument say it's unfounded, at least at this point. Then would it be appropriate to spread it everywhere on the part of the individuals and create a situation of discord and disunity in the congregation. So it's not as though they're being silent and told, don't mention this to anyone. They came to the elders, that's appropriate. If they say, now we're going to the police department or the authorities who have a right to know and make this known, that's their decision. They certainly can follow through on that. But with any matter that is going to be handled in some way by authorities who are assigned to it, it's not something that you would generally want just gossip and spread about the way. But even with that being the case, and now switching to a scenario where, okay, this is the case, it is made known, a person does not come under the discipline of the congregation simply because he speaks or repeats these things. Because in order to qualify scripturally for what we consider slander, and we make a distinction between gossip and slander. Slander is the more serious offense, but it has to have bad motive and maliciousness involved, which distinguishes this from someone who believes this or has heard this, and they whisper it or repeat it to others. That's not slander. And passing information in that way or gossiping about it is discouraged, but it doesn't carry with it sanctions as some discipline of reproof or disfellowshipping. Because clearly when you get into those particular attributes, you must have bad motive attributed to it rather than just somewhat newsy and passing information along for others. So we clearly make that distinction. So no one is hauled before a judicial committee or setting simply because in some newsworthy manner they repeated something they heard about a certain individual.
I see. So you mentioned reporting to authorities. Has there ever been in print or delivered from the platform to your knowledge in any, you know, different meeting? That piece of information, you know, let me be clear, I apologize. I know a lot about the world of Jehovah's Witnesses and that you very much have self-contained communities. Okay. And so you're loath to involve outsiders since you see your elders as in their positions by Holy Spirit, etc. So you can see there's a predilection there not to involve outsiders. Has there ever been specific instruction to publishers that it is okay for them to call police first in cases of allegations of child abuse?
Well, I think I would say to that that maybe the premise that you state is not exactly the way we feel about it. For example, first or second or whatever happens to be the case is not something that we make an issue of. In other words, you must first come and report this to the elders, then thereafter you report this to authorities and all. We're sure that if an individual is faced with such a situation that they're going to go to the authorities or the police, that might be the first thing they would think of, particularly if it has taken place in a certain circumstance. So we're not making any issue over the order. Our position in it is that if a person feels that this is something that should be reported to authorities, then that's the decision that they would have to make. We're not going to tell them not to or discourage them to, because but they would have their reasons why they feel it should be reported. If they have done this when they come to the elders, then that's not a matter that we're going to get involved in. We do recognize sexual molestation of children is a crime.
Yes, of course. I guess let me restate my question to be a bit more clear. I noticed in the February 15, 2002 letters to the bodies of elders that it was carefully stated that elders would not want to discourage people from going to the proper authorities in such circumstances. But I guess my question is a little bit the inverse of that. Would the elders educate the publishers that that's an option? You know, the publishers are coming to the elders for guidance, and if the elders don't say, well, you might want to call the police, you know, then they're going to get a message from that. you know, aside from just not discouraging them. Does that make sense?
Well, but I think you have to balance it out with this, Mike. And I can just put it this way in an illustration that in some way might do you appear to be hyperbole, but nevertheless it may make a point. If you live in a society such as that as Afghanistan, would you want to go to the authorities and make known a situation of child molestation? Let's make it rhetorical, because it doesn't serve, because, you know, it's hypothetical anyway. But all I was illustrating here is we deal with a worldwide society. Our principles, we have to be principles applied everywhere. We don't feel they need to be adjusted because people think a different way. At the same time, if there are existing laws in a certain land or state that require something, and these do not conflict with what is clearly stated as God's law, then we feel we should comply. But I think you have to have some latitude here when you're dealing with a global, international organization. So this is why sometimes, as you illustrated there, it's read in a way that might seem somewhat weak in one place, but yet, if you live in another place or society, it may be just what's needed to afford you a protection that would be needed in that particular circumstance.
Understood.
That's all I was illustrating. And don't take my illustration to, you know, to be so meaningful, except to illustrate what you have to keep in mind when you deal with a global organization and not just something that's U.S.-based.
Right. Okay, well, let's move on.
Sure.
There was a period of time that you were supervising or involved with writing correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
Were you aware during that period of time of a significant volume of correspondence coming in, phone calls coming in, dealing with allegations of child molestation in the organization?
Well, let me answer it this way. Maybe just a little background, because I don't know what you've been told, but you called me because you wanted my side of the story.
Absolutely.
When we made a cover series on the matter of molestation in our Kin 891 awake, it precipitated considerable correspondence on this subject from all around the world. For the most part, the correspondence was like this. Someone would start telling us what had happened to them and what their experience was in the congregation. And going through all of this, what our main effort was, as far as the point of view of the writing department, was to actually see and understand what was out there. And then we did publish a little follow-up where some of the comments or letters at least were repeated in a later issue of Awake.
Yes, I did. I read that.
Okay. In other words, to sort of see what was out there, what they were saying, and then, of course, all of this information was passed along in summary from the writing committee to the governing body. Now, when you introduce the terminology cover-up, now, where cover-up starts to present a problem is because this is absolutely wrong. We don't condone the covering up of sin. You yourself mentioned that we aim for a very high standard in applying Christian principles.
Yes, so sir. That, but my question still was there a large volume of mail coming in that alleged cover-up?
Not, hello?
I'm sorry. You still there? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hello? You still there, sir?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I think I'll call the line to go there.
I'm sorry.
Go right ahead. You had interrupted to restate your question.
Yes, sir. I was just saying that I was just asking if you had received a large volume of correspondence that alleged that child sexual molestation was not being handled properly. No, I wasn't alleging that it wasn't happening, you know, or that there was a cover-up, just if there was a large amount of correspondence that allege that things were not being handled properly?
The answer specifically to that would be no, because the greater amount of that particular correspondent was not accusing cover-up or not handling it. It, for the most part, dealt with people telling their stories. Some of it had been reported, some of it had not. It was just like the recent television program that many people saw. This, again, has sort of nudged some people, well, let me say what my story is, let me say what has happened to me. But when you get into matters like that, Mike, that involve discipline, then that leaves the writing department, and that's turned over to the department that handles the congregation administratively and seeing that proper discipline is to be cared for. We call that here the service department. So in writing, we were merely seeing what was out there, what the people were saying, what stories they had to tell. If elements there involved the administration of our policy, such as the terminology you use, cover up, and it certainly wasn't a large amount of that. But as you know, humans are humans, and some are going to say, this was not handled properly, or I was told that I should not make this known. We're not saying people who mention these allegations are all untruthful or making up things. That would not be appropriate. But at the same time, these were matters that were handed over to the department that cares for these, and then they were assigned in whatever appropriate ways that they should to follow through, as well as to be guided by what people were saying and formulating principles for handling these things.
Let me, if I may, paraphrase something that Barbara Anderson had said in regard to this specific topic. She said, when the October 8, 1991, A Wave on Child Abuse came out, it appeared to reverse earlier feelings against psychotherapy and repressed memories, and elders were calling headquarters for clarification. She said the service department did not go along with that. The articles were viewed as a mistake, that there was a battle going on at Bethel between these two factions, the man who was the head of the service department and the man who was the head of the writing department. Both members of the governing body didn't agree on these things.
Do you like my comment on that?
Please.
Okay. Firsthand, as you know, at that time I was a part of the writing department. And maybe understanding a little about the process as to how we arrive at various conclusions here might be helpful in this case. And I should clarify this. My response is not to take on anything that you may have been told by Barbara Anderson or others. We do not consider these people our enemies. We are not seeking controversy with them. All I'm seeking to do here, because you contacted me, is to explain, here's our side of the story. So when it comes down to that basic thing, we have here a process with anything that is different or new or coming in as a problem to have it researched and talked about. And admittedly, you can go through a lot of raw material. So were there many different opinions on this matter around here? On any matter, there are different opinions that exist. They're talked about. They're analyzed. But how things are finally decided, we have a decision-making body. The information is spread, fed to them. Then they make a decision on the matter that they are to appear in print. And then when this is written up by the writing department, it's read by those who make the decision. When it is finally approved and out of the door, this is what we all support. So if someone in an earlier stage said, well, this department thought things should go this way, this department or individual felt that something was to go this way, very likely this is the case. That's in any subject that comes up. You have, as you know, since you are a reporter, journalist, or involved in that field, that you're going to have raw material back and forth. You're going to have edits made on anything. But what finally counts? When you put it in print and it goes out of the door. Then if you say to me, who's backing that? I'm backing it.
Yes, sir.
I support it. Now, if you say, do you always 100% agree with every single thing? Well, I think you know the human mind well enough to say, well, the mind will sometimes reserve little questions here or there in it. But if you are loyal to a certain organization and its point of view, whether it's religious or commercial or political, then you support matters when they are decided upon. So if you say what their disunity in supporting what the Watchtower had made known and published, yes, there was unity, there was support for that. If you say, now, were further adjustments or changes needed in it? Well, you simply look at the period of time that's passed from then to now, and you can see the continual refinement of the policies that we had from here in relation to this and other matters. We like to think of ourselves as progressive. So if you are progressive, you are refining according to the conditions that you face at a given time. Will there yet be refinements in our policies? Of course there will be. So I'm not going to lead you to believe that, oh no, everybody was on the same page all the time. When you go through the process that journalism requires of research, debating, and coming up with raw material and ideas, it's a normal function for things to be sorted out at that level. And I think if you've worked in an environment like that, an office environment, people are doing sort of speaker networking, going from one office to another, talking it over. This is part of the process. So I don't think you can dismiss this as part of a legitimate process. Now, if you compare it to what finally is put in print or comes out officially as policy of the organization, it can often be quite different from the way things started in the earlier stages. So this is how I would respond to something like that.
I appreciate that. Let me just ask one other fact, if you could verify, I mean, confirm or deny this. Barbara Anderson was also the source for this, but she said that in the 90s there was a push by the legal department to have uniform reporting requirements across all 50 states and the District of Columbia, but that that proposal was rejected by the governing body. Can you confirm or deny that?
I was not privy to that. I did not work in legal, and if any particular proposal was made, we all make such proposals directly to the governing body. So I was a part of the writing committee representing the department made proposals from there and legal made proposals. Now, to be very candid with you on it, I just was not privy to that information.
Okay.
But I'm not going to say if someone else gave it to you that they don't know what they're talking about. Because as I mentioned, a lot of raw material exists before something is decided.
Very good, thank you. My fourth question is, I understand that those who are disabled or otherwise impaired are allowed to do telephone or letter writing witnessing. And my question was, why not have those who have a history of known child abuse engage in letter writing or phone witnessing or some alternative form of service? Why send them out knocking on people's doors?
I would have no objection to that. And the fact of the matter is, the elders handling the matter certainly have the latitude to make that part of their restrictions on the individual. So that if, in fact, a person is a known pedophile, and I think here we need to say, we're talking about a predatory pedophile, then limiting that one's exposure to children in any environment that you can control is a good one. So what you state there is something within the jurisdiction of the elders handling the case to do. And the fact of the matter is they do, in certain cases, actually institute that. They do instruct the person not to participate in that service, and in fact, if it's done, they require often that the person be accompanied by someone else. But what you're saying, yes, that should be done.
I appreciate it could be done. I guess my question is in regard to the watch out January 1st, 1997, Speaking of a molester who may recently have been released from prison, it said, quote, if he seems to be repentant, he will be encouraged to make spiritual progress and share in the field ministry, meaning door-to-door service, or would you broaden that definition to include possible alternative forms of service?
The field ministry includes any avenue of giving the witness. So if it was to the exclusion of going house to house, then that did not mean that he was not participating in field service. If he was participating in what is the door-to-door work, that's one thing, but we consider just as valid if he sits on a bench in a mall with magazines and offers them to people there, or if he calls up on the telephone. All of it is reported as witnessing.
Sure. And I noted that in recent interaction with the press, you had mentioned that when a known pedophile goes door-to-door, he's always accompanied with an escort. Is that escort always aware of his background, of his weakness or predilection?
If it has been announced, and generally speaking, everyone would know it. See, here's a setting for us that's a little different. Like, if a person is just familiar with a normal church system.
Well, sir,
but I wanted to say, when you go to our congregations, 100, 150, everybody knows everybody else. They know where they live. They know the names of your children. So if the elders disfellowship someone, you know, even though we never name the reason, in a very short time, everybody is aware of what goes on. I think you're aware of human nature, and they can pursue it to you again. If they're reinstated, then they know, okay, they've overcome this. If they're given a proof, if they are given a reproof, then people can figure it out because they know the personality, the character of the personality. And to be quite honest, we know each other's weaknesses. If someone has propensity to drink too much, alcoholic beverage, I mean, then if you listen to them being reproved and you've been at maybe a gathering or so and you saw them go too far, then you just about know, okay, this person's weakness is alcohol and he had to get a reproof for it. So it's not in a setting where you've got 1,000 or 1,500 people and they remain basically anonymous to one another. Maybe with the exception of just seeing one another in a church service. We are organized like a closely knit family. So that setting is different than just in a normal church setting.
Sure. But to answer the question, then, the person may or may not be aware of what the allegation against the person was that would have caused them to be privately or publicly reproved.
You know, what my answer to that would be rarely just that. And why would I say that? Because one, I understand human nature. I've been in these congregations for a lifetime.
I'm sorry, rarely would what be the case, sir?
That someone would know. You know, I've been in these congregations since a kid. And you hear somebody read off this fellowship or you hear somebody reproved, you know, as a 12-year-old kid, I could sit there and I knew what was going on. Why? Because you are a part of this. So if you say, is it possible for someone to not know, my answer to that would be that situation would be very, very rare.
Okay, thank you. My last question is, in the January 1st, 1997 Watchtower, it indicated that someone who had a history of being a known child molester would not be extended privileges of service, meaning they couldn't be made an elder or a ministerial servant. But then in a March 14th letter to all bodies of elders, just 3 months later, it stated to the elders that by known pedophile, it indicated their notoriety in the community, not what they had actually done. And my question is, why was that change, which appears to allow a known pedophile to remain in a position of authority, never communicated to the rank and file?
Well, you have to look at the overall picture. I don't know if you had an opportunity in your research. Seem very well researched to look at the response letter that we sent along to the BBC.
I did.
Okay. You remember in part of that, we took up the specific matter on pedophilia, how, according to some states, what's classified as pedophilia doesn't involve a predatory pedophile. an example was given there. Well, let's say you have a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old, male and female, get mixed up in some illicit conduct in the congregation. All right, because in some states the 16-year-old is considered to be adult, the 14-year-old is minor, then this goes down into the records as here is someone who is molesting a child. All right, well, let's say, as was pointed out there, 3 years later, the same two individuals get married. They had earlier been immoral, but now they get married. All right, now he's old enough a little later to be considered for some privilege in the congregation. Well, he probably just denied it for a while, so that's the number that he gets straight now. But let's just run it to the extreme and say 20 years later, he's married, he has several children, the children are somewhat grown. Should we keep him classified congregationally as a pedophile, a predatory pedophile? He did get involved with a minor, but it was more sort of a consensual act of fornication than it was technically an act of pedophilia. So when you get situations like that, and you start weighing them in terms of what you stated, then it appears, well, there needs to be some clarification. At least the door shouldn't be closed too tightly here, so that here's a person, got mixed up in wrongful conduct, obviously is a terror, not a pedophile really at all in practice, but technically did get involved with a minor in that way. And that's why this, as an example, was presented. It requires some balance, some judgment, some looking at all the facts, rather than just hard and fast rules. But now, if you've got a predatory pedophile here that's no, well, what was stated there is clear. We still have the means to keep him from ever serving again. And we stand by that.
Okay, but I guess I'll boil my question down just a little bit more for you. I appreciate your response. The March 14, 1997 DOE letter said, an individual known to be a former child molester has reference to the perception of that one in the community. However, that was not a definition that was provided in the Watchtower, and that's not a definition, to my knowledge, that was ever subsequently communicated to the membership. My question is, wouldn't it seem that a witness would have taken the January 1st Watchtower to mean that a person with a known history of child molestation could not be in a position of authority? And didn't the March 14th letter seem to soften or even backpedal on that stance?
Well, I explained how we looked at it, and this is, you know, the way that you put your question. Now you say, could someone have understood that to mean that in no way could one ever serve in that capacity once again? Yes. That could have been the conclusion. It may have been the obvious conclusion. But if there is some exception made to this, and it was explained to the elders, and it is not a part of our standard way of handling things to always inform every detail of matters to the congregation or the publishers in general, because sometimes matters that are to be too inveterate involve for the elders, but it was clarified to them. It was explained. But even when that's the case, the elders don't just decide and say a point is what. They have to make their case. They have to write in explaining why they feel this way. What were the circumstances? Why do you feel that there must be an exception here? And in most cases, maybe it would even stand up. But if you're going to approach anything in a balanced way, taking in all of the factors that, of course, reflect understanding of the situation, then it seemed appropriate to allow that some latitude for making the decision in specific cases could be granted on the part of the governing body. And if that is the case, then it can be considered in that way. But no effort was made here to hide something that is a general truth. What is stated there and the way it is stated there without the clarification certainly is what happens most of the time. even more than that, which happens almost all of the time that way. But it merely acknowledges there could possibly be some exception. If that's felt to be the case, then make it known and we'll take a look at it. That's what it's saying there. We feel it's a reasonable position to take.
Okay, thank you. I think I get your gist on that. Well, that was all the questions I had. As I mentioned, I have some other things that Barbara Anderson brought up. If I could just ask you one more thing, you can.
I'll take one more.
Well, I appreciate that. It's kind of a two-parter. You know, is your current policy? I understand the passage vacillated or adjusted your understanding of the biblical principle that if a woman screams during rape, that she may or may not be guilty of fornication. What is your current stance on that? And, you know, can you speak to that subject a little bit?
Okay, now you're switching to rape.
Yes, sir.
Okay. On the matter of rape, we have a fairly consistent policy that we feel is biblically oriented. The Bible requires if a woman is attacked, even in an isolated place, that she should scream. Why? Well, it makes practical sense. It's not something that the Bible has said. If you look at what many authorities say now, they say, keep up some commotion, you know, scream or make some noise. Maybe if someone shows up, it will end the attack. We feel that is a reasonable position to take. So if this has been done, then we're not going to view that, obviously, as some immorality. But we feel, as with anything else you feel strongly about, should you not stand up for it? We feel very strongly about living a clean and decent life, not being immoral. So then if we can in any way be resistant to this, then we're willing to do it, even if it is a life-threatening situation.
So have there been situations where women have been disciplined by the congregation, at least in part because they did not scream during a rape?
I can't comment, say, on every single instance, but I can give you what our point of view of here is what we say. For example, I can recall one situation that came to our attention. Well, some are petrified, and they're almost paralyzed by the situation, and thus unable to scream or put up any resistance. Well, this seems to line up with the fact that can be the experience of some persons. So if in weighing the case, the elders see, well, actually, this person did all that they possibly could. You couldn't have expected more in this case. Then applying the hard and fast rule that no specific audible noise was made would not necessarily have to apply in that case. I think what you have to recall, when elders sit down to render a judgment, they're able to ask questions and consider all the various factors that may impact that particular situation. And then based on that, they make a judgment as much in harmony with the scriptures as they possibly can.
Thank you.
So we recognize there can be some exceptional circumstances.
Understood.
That's my point on that, Mike.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time today. I hope that if I have some follow-up items next week, I might be able to get through to you.
If we have to clear up something, Mike, you can give me a ring back. See if Bryce can, you know, let me know about it so we can line it up.
Yeah.
And we thank you for calling and checking with us.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. And I hope, you know, off the record, I hope that you do move toward a policy of educating members to call police first. I think it would prevent a lot of pain all around.
I appreciate very much your concern, and you can be assured our concern is what do we need to do, if anything, to make this better and stronger, because what things we know have happened, as reported, we want to prevent this. As you said, we're an organization that strives for a very high standard.
Thank you, sir.
You have a good day.
You, sir.
Goodbye.